Ladies and gentlemen, good day and welcome to a webinar where we will be discussing the impact and analysis of the protocol that has amended the India-Mauritius Tax Treaty. This event is being organized by Nishit Desai Associates. Speaker for panel discussions are Mr. Nishit Desai, founder and managing partner for Nishit Desai Associates, Mr. Nishchal Joshipura, partner for M&A and private equity from Nishit Desai Associates, Mr. Rajesh Simhan, partner for international tax practices from Nishit Desai and Associates, Richie Sancheti, head of fund formation, and Ms. Mansi Seth, head for US office from Nishit Desai Associates. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode, and there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal for an operator by pressing star, then zero on your touchtone phone. Also, you can download our mobile applet, Nishit Mobile, which is available on the App Store for iOS devices, Play Store for Android, and BlackBerry World to access the current updates and videos. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Nishchal Joshipura. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Welcome to all the participants joining this webinar. As you are aware, India and Mauritius signed tax treaty protocol yesterday, amending the India-Mauritius tax treaty on capital gains. The key amendment which has been proposed in the protocol is that going forward from 1st April 2017, India will have the right to tax capital gains owned by Mauritius companies from sale of shares of Indian companies. This is a significant development in the history of taxation in India, considering the fact that almost 50% of foreign investment into India comes through Mauritius and Singapore. This amendment is also going to impact the investments coming through Singapore, since the India Mauritius and the India-Singapore tax treaty are linked. Before we delve deep into the amendments and its impact on Mauritius, Singapore and Dutch structures, it would be interesting to spend a couple of minutes on the history of Mauritius and how it came about. The India-Mauritius tax treaty was signed in 1984, and interestingly, when the treaty was signed, India negotiated a capital gains article in a manner where when Indian companies sell shares of Mauritius companies, they don't have to pay any capital gains tax in Mauritius. And somehow this article was negotiated that it has to be mutual. So India always thought that this article is going to be used more by India than by Mauritius. Interestingly, from 1984 to 1991, there was hardly any investment which came through Mauritius into India. In 1991, when India opened up, there were a number of US investors who wanted to invest into India. But the biggest issue that they were facing was when they invested directly into India, there was an issue of double taxation. So when US companies exit from Indian companies, India had the right to tax, given the fact that the status of the shares was in India. And US also had the right to tax, because US taxes where the holder resides. And because of the way the source rules work in both the countries, there was an issue of getting tax credit for the Indian taxes paid in the US. So effectively, the US investors had to pay taxes both in India and in the US, and it was resulting into double taxation. To avoid this issue of double taxation, Mauritius was interposed between India and US so that there is only one layer of tax in the US, given the fact that Mauritius companies were getting capital gains tax exemption when they sold their securities in Indian companies. That became the model for most of the investments coming into India post-1991. And there were a number of rulings right from Supreme Court ruling of Azadi Bachao Andolan till the latest one being the Punjab and Haryana High Court ruling on the in case of Blackstone and Sarkodie, where the courts blessed the Mauritius India tax treaty. And the tax department in the last 25 years was not successful in challenging the Mauritius India tax treaty and winning any significant case. So the only alternative that was left was to amend the treaty. And as we all know, the talks about the renegotiation have been going on for almost a decade. And finally, they were successful in renegotiating the treaty. Now, it will be interesting to hear from Mr. Nishit Desai, who has been associated with advising number of Mauritius entities investing into India since the past 25 years, and was also instrumental in developing Mauritius as an offshore financial services center for investing into India. So Nishit, would you like to comment on the revised treaty protocol and what are your views on that?
Yes, thank you very much, Nishit, for laying out a brief history of how the Mauritius treaty came to be used by global investors and in particular by the U.S. investors. And by the way, I am right now in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley, and good morning to everybody here on this side of the world, and good evening and good late evening to the other people on the Eastern Hemisphere. As Michel just pointed out, Mauritius Treaty has been in existence since 1983 and it was notified in 1984, I believe. So it's almost now 32 years. And, you know, 30 years makes a generation. So the treaty has been in existence for a generation now. And, but important thing is that Mauritius has played a very critical role in attracting investment into India. Right from the inception, the focus of Mauritius government has been to develop a robust and transparent offshore financial center that attracted reputed financial investors to use Mauritius as a platform for investment into India. And as Nishit laid out, the Mauritius treaty was used in early 90s when India opened up. We all remember that on June 21st, 1991, India opened up. And soon thereafter, Mauritius developed its offshore regime. And at that point of time, the whole idea was to see that there is no double taxation of the same income. Many around the world think that the treaty was abused for avoidance of taxes in both the countries, or it was for avoidance of taxes altogether, that is in India and Mauritius, but especially the U.S. investors who did not pay tax in India, did not pay tax in Mauritius, but when they bring back income to the U.S., they had to pay tax. So whole idea was to avoid double taxation of the same income rather than avoiding all the taxes altogether. Now, the most of the initial companies in Mauritius were set up, there were funds, as you all know. And again, we had some role to play in developing the offshore regime in Mauritius, and it's been very interesting that the regime has always remained very open, transparent. Exchange of information has been done by Mauritius without hesitation in the cases that were needed. And in fact, Indian government has been able to put tax officials also in Mauritius so that there is no abuse of the treaty as such. And the Indian government was also instrumental actually in promoting the Mauritius route. It, as you all will recall, Indian government vehemently defended the Mauritius route before the Supreme Court in Azadi Bachao Andolan, besides issuing circulars to ensure that the treaty benefit on capital gains were provided to Mauritius companies. So if you all recall, It was Indian government which defended Mauritius Treaty and the use of Mauritius Treaty in the Supreme Court. And given the fact that India and Mauritius enjoy tremendous political, economic, cultural ties, I think this was a very good gesture. It must be recalled that during the 90s, when the treaty was first started to be extensively used, the capital gains tax rates in India were significantly higher than what you see today. Maybe at 25% on long term to 50% on short term, and so on and so forth. So tax rates were pretty high at that point of time. And investors, especially those from the US, as I mentioned, were concerned on direct investment into India due to credit mismatch issue that arose due to the source rules differences in the US. And the concern for the US investors was that taxes paid in India on capital gains were not available or necessarily available as a tax credit in the US. And that was one of the most important things. But with the time, what has happened is with the time, the tax rates have now been lowered. As you know, capital gains tax rates have come down to a level of 10% and in some cases 5% and so on and so forth. But when the tax rates were so high and foreign investment was deterred by the high tax rates, at that point of time, Mauritius Treaty came very handy. It has really played an important role in the last 32 years. And over the last decade in particular, the stance of government in respect of Mauritius Treaty has undergone change, and everyone was expecting amendment to the treaty almost since the Supreme Court gave a judgment sometime in 2004. And since then, everybody was expecting that at a point of time, the treaty would be amended. Now, it's almost 10, 12 years since the judgment came in. And so it is not coming as a surprise or complete surprise, and or it's an absolute bolt out of the blue. So people were expecting. Given the fact that the treaty now is being amended, it is also important to note, and as we will go along in the course of today's discussion, that the both the governments must be complemented to make an effort to see that there is an orderly phasing out of the capital gains taxation over a period of 3 years without unduly burdening the investors who invested in India relying on the treaty. This has ensured that there is no knee-jerk reaction that has happened, unlike in the past, due to the revisions in the treaty. Other interesting feature, or it's more importantly, apart from changing the capital gains tax benefit, renegotiating a reduced rate of 7.5% on interest being paid from India will also usher India-Mauritius tax relationship into a new era. While the press release only talks about increase in the rate of tax for banks, my understanding is that 7.5% tax rate on interest will be extended to all investors who are investing from Mauritius. India has very shallow debt market, and it is likely that India will get a boost to debt market providing for a reduced rate of tax on interest. Already, we are seeing India relaxing its exchange controls to facilitate the investment, and we have seen that exchange controls have also been relaxed for a debt from overseas. In some circumstances, even tax on interest has been reduced to a level of 5% in India, but not across the board. The protocol will make Mauritius even more attractive at this point in time, that Singapore or Cyprus, Netherlands, etc., at least for the debt investment. We must celebrate the implementation of the treaty by both countries in good faith for all these years. Time and again, despite all the news reports on treaty benefit being denied, at the highest levels in government, the view has been that any change has to be made through an amendment to the treaty. In fact, we must acknowledge that Indian capital gains taxes, as I mentioned, were very high, and Mauritius treaty, along with the offshore financial regime in Mauritius, reduced the rigors of Indian taxes and facilitated large amount of foreign investment into India, making India into growth driver for the world economy that we see today. The changes to the treaty will, of course, lead to some short-term impact on investments in India. There are unresolved tax issues that especially arise in the context of P-notes issued by FPIs or FIs. Further today, unfortunately, there is an artificial characterization of business income of the FPI or FIIs, as it used to be called earlier, being treated as capital gain. This leads to a situation where even portfolio trading investors who would have otherwise not been taxable in India are being subjected to tax in India. As you know, if you have a business income in India without having a permanent establishment, then the foreign investor is not liable to tax. But in case of FPIFIs, even the business income arising as a result of trading of shares, you know, is being characterized as capital gain. So there's artificial characterization of the income, and that causes some problems. So hopefully government will revisit this issue and align position with other countries where mere trading of Indian mere trading in Indian securities should not give rise to tax implications in India, absent a permanent establishment. This artificiality is unfair and also gives rise to possible non-availability of tax credits in the home country. While the government has renegotiated treaty with Mauritius, it is also hoped that they will continue on the path of tax reforms to ensure that the investors are not put off by constant adverse changes to the tax policy. And these are my preliminary comments. And one of the other things that we need to bear in mind is that besides tax, Mauritius also has a very well-drafted bilateral investment protection treaty, which doesn't exist with several other countries, including with the U.S. at this point in time. I just learned that U.S. is suggesting to Indian government to put in place a bilateral investment protection treaty before the visit of Prime Minister Modi to the U.S. in the next month for a dinner with Mr. Obama. And we hope that our environment will continue to improve. And as we have seen, there has been significant reforms in India in the last year and a half. And we hope that actually overall environment in India will improve and the relationship with India and Mauritius will grow into the next level of excitement. And this, with those words, let me now turn it back, turn this microphone back to Nishchal. And I thank you so much for your patience at this point in time. Thank you. Nishchal, over to you.
Thanks,
and those who are here in Palo Alto, welcome. And Nishal, can you take it over from me?
Yeah. Thanks, Nishit. I think we can now go deep into the amendments which have been mentioned in the protocol. Although the protocol is not yet out, but there is a press release which has been issued. And there are a number of changes which have been proposed in the press release. Maybe Mansi, can you throw light on the changes which have been agreed in the protocol which has been signed between India and Mauritius?
Sure, Nishal. Thank you. But before I get into the changes that have been introduced, maybe a quick recap of what the current position is. And of course, Nishit and Nishal both have briefly mentioned. But generally speaking, the way a foreign investor it would be taxed in India would only be to the extent of the foreign investor's Indian-sourced income. Now, specifically talking about capital gains, the way the Indian domestic law reads, it basically provides that capital gains from transfer of any capital asset which is situated in India, which would, of course, include shares in an Indian company or securities in an Indian company, that would be taxable in India. So to that extent, foreign investors have an exposure under Indian domestic law. This is where the tax treaties come into play. And, of course, the India-Mauritius tax treaty, which for years has been used for making investment. And the reason being that the way the treaty is drafted, of course, leaving aside permanent establishment or immovable property, it provides that gains from, earned by a Mauritius resident from property that is situated in India would be taxable in Mauritius. As such, the foreign investors, as long as they can rely on the Indian-Mauritius tax treaty, and in spite of consistent challenges by the revenue authorities, have been able to invest in India without having capital gains tax in India. Now, of course, the capital gains tax in India range from 0 to 40%, depending upon the type of security, listed, unlisted, short-term, long-term. As such, this treaty has been providing a very favorable tax position for the foreign investors. And it is this clause that the protocol seeks to amend. What they, at least from the press release, and as Nishchal mentioned, we don't have the fine print of the protocol yet. We only have a press release which lays down some of the key features of the amendments. So as for the press release, it seems that gains from alienation of shares in Indian companies would now be taxable in India. So India will get that right and Mauritius loses. So this raises an interesting question, as is this only limited to equity shares or what about the other securities? Now, normally, if we look at tax treaties and the way they're worded, they have a clause specifically dealing with alienation of shares, and then they would have a residuary clause. Of course, there are exceptions, but generally speaking. And the residuary clause would typically provide that such gains would be taxable where the transferor is located. So what we need to watch out for in the protocol, of course, is has India gained this right to tax only with respect to equity shares, and where would the other securities fall in? The other question that arises is, now, when is this applicable from, or what happens to the current investments? The protocol, the press release provides that the amendment will be applicable from 1st April 2017. And it seems that existing investments are completely grandfathered, which basically means that as long as you invest on or before 31st March 2017, it doesn't matter when you exit, you will be able to rely, you should be able to rely on the current India-Mauritius tax treaties. And the new the protocol will not be applicable. The press release makes it clear that there is also a transitionary period for 2 years, which starts from 1st April 2017 till 31st March 2019. During this period, a beneficial rate of 50% of the Indian domestic rate will be applicable. Now, what that means, what should be noted is, it talks about capital gains that are earned during this period, which means not only should you invest in this 2 years, you may also have to exit prior to 1st April 2019 in order to be able to get this 50% beneficial rate. Now, as many of you probably know, the long-term holding for unlisted shares itself is 2 years. So therefore, this clause might have limited utility, or this transition period might have utility for some investors, but at least for short-term gains or listed securities, investors may be able to rely on this transitionary period. And then the other thing to note about the 50% rate is you also need to satisfy the limitation of benefits clause, which earlier wasn't there in the Mauritius Treaty, and they've introduced that, which provides that the Mauritius entity should be able to satisfy a main purpose and bona fide business tests. Of course, they haven't, right now we don't have details of what the test will read like, but the indication will probably be like the usual, that tax avoidance shouldn't be the main purpose, etc., or tax shouldn't be the principal reason for setting it up. But in addition to that, they also have a deeming provision, which says that the Mauritius entity will be deemed to be a shell or a conduit if it doesn't meet the minimum expense threshold requirement, which is about 27 lakhs rupees, $40,000 in the preceding 12 months. So this the limitation of benefit clause is similar to what we've, not exactly the same, but along the lines of what we've seen under the Singapore Treaty. And speaking of Singapore, as Nishil had already mentioned, the treaties are linked. It had clearly provided when India and Singapore had negotiated the protocol and introduced this capital gains benefit, which is similar to Mauritius, the protocol clearly provided that these benefits will not survive if the benefits under the India-Mauritius tax treaty will fall away. And this is, of course, we'll discuss this in more detail, but this is how any change to the capital gains benefit under the India-Mauritius treaty impacts the India-Singapore treaty as well. Other than the capital gains clause, there have also been changes proposed to the interest clause, which talks about a 7.5% withholding when payments are made to banks. It also alludes to changes in the exchange of information clauses and other income source taxation, etc., but no further details have been provided under the press release. And I think, Nishil, back to you. These are the main changes that have been proposed so far.
Thanks, Mansi. The next question is to Rajesh. Rajesh, there are a number of general partners who are on road to raise the next India Focus Fund. And there will be many in the next 2-3 years who will be raising India Focus Fund. The biggest question which all the general partners are facing is, how do we invest into India? Traditionally, it was a no-brainer that Mauritius is the best jurisdiction for making equity investments into India, and there was no competition as such. However, with this protocol, what would be your advice to the clients on investing into India when they're setting up India Focus Fund, or if a global fund is making India investment, what would be the choice of jurisdiction which you would suggest?
Sure. Thanks, Michelle. Again, stepping back, if you look at it traditionally in terms of investments into India and jurisdictions which have some kind of treaty protection, especially when it comes to capital gains, the four countries which sort of come to your mind every single time is Mauritius, Singapore, Cyprus, and Netherlands. These have been the four traditional countries, so to say, where investors have used as far as investment into India is concerned. Now, looking at just how the position stands revised post the protocol coming into play, the first one is that as far as Mauritius is concerned today, as things stand, I think come 1st of April 2017, the right to tax obviously will vest with India if the investments have been made after that period, subject to obviously the 2-year window which is there. And that's the tax cost, at least if you're a private equity fund, you're looking at least the tax cost of 10%, unless really the exit is through IPO. The alternate choice, which has been pretty common, let's say, especially in the last 2 or 3 years data, anybody who looks at the FDI inflows, we'll probably see a big chunk of investment coming in from Singapore. I think Singapore, in fact, actually overtook Mauritius recently as far as FDI inflows are concerned. The challenge that is there today, even as far as the Singapore Treaty is concerned, which Mansi pointed out, is that the Singapore Treaty is inextricably linked to the Mauritius Treaty. So what the protocol to the capital gains tax provision in the Singapore Treaty effectively provides for is to say that if there is any change as far as the rules of taxation relating to capital gains under the India-Mauritius Treaty is concerned, the benefit under the India-Singapore Treaty goes off in entirety. So as things stand today, even insofar as any investments from Singapore are concerned, they will be subject to a tax in India. There are a couple of issues which are today currently that are there. The first being that unlike in case of Mauritius, where the protocol seems to provide for a grandfathering of investments made prior to 31st March 2017, the change to the Mauritius Treaty effectively brings about the situation where the Singapore Treaty benefit on capital gains goes off in entirety. So you don't really have the benefit of grandfathering provisions coming into place. Having said that, we have been given to understand from the MOF, I think they have made some public statements in this regard, that they will be looking at actively renegotiating the Singapore Treaty to provide similar benefits which the Mauritius Treaty Protocol sort of provides for in terms of grandfathering of investments. So at least hopefully it is expected that even insofar as the Singapore Treaty is concerned, the grandfathering of benefits will still apply. The two other countries which are sort of left today, one is Cyprus. Cyprus, unfortunately, has gone through a bit of a tumble where the government had, the Indian government had decided to notify Cyprus as a notified jurisdiction, which essentially today means that even though the treaty provides for a residence-based taxation for capital gains, which essentially means that only Cyprus has the right to tax, because of the notification by the Indian government, any payments made to a Cypriot resident today is subject to a minimum tax of at least 20%. This matter is currently being litigated. We do have to see how this pans out, even as far as the Supreme Court is concerned. Which sort of takes you back to really the only country which is left, which is Netherlands. Now, when you talk about Netherlands, Netherlands probably doesn't have as good a treaty benefit as what Mauritius used to have till yesterday, or Singapore, in the sense that what the Netherlands treaty essentially provides is that if you're a portfolio investor holding less than 10%, there is no problem. If you're holding more than that, the issue that happens is that if you're selling to a non-resident, there are no tax consequences. It's only Netherlands which has the right to tax. But if you're selling to an Indian resident, the right to tax actually vests with India. So to a certain extent, people have sort of been looking at Netherlands as an alternative option as far as investments into India are concerned. I think if you think about it, you sort of need to bucket it into two broad categories. One is portfolio investors, which are essentially the FIIs and the FPIs. I won't deal with the P notes for the time being. I will let Richie sort of talk about it. And the other is the private equity investors. I think in both cases, you will have probably a tendency to move towards some of the European jurisdictions, which do have certain benefits, either when you're a portfolio investor, for example, even you can even look at structures around Dutch structures or around structures using Sweden as a holding company also, which we've seen in the past. So I think that's one thing that you're going to see happen in future in terms of the kind of jurisdictions where investors will move towards. When they are looking at making equity investments into India. Having said that, I also do believe that the reduction in tax rates, especially when you think about it, capital gains tax on long-term capital gains coming down to a 10% rate, I think it will also lead to a situation where a lot of the players may actually look at not trying to see whether there are any structures which offer tax arbitrage, but to do a plain vanilla structure and sort of look at the tax as a cost of doing business in India, whether it plays out in the valuations of the company or in terms of the returns expectations of LPs or GPs. That's, I think, the other thing which may tend to happen. You will probably also see a lot more push towards exits through IPO. I think at least right now, for the time being, you've got a good market for IPO-related exits. But today, if you think about it in the larger landscape, that's one of the few places where you do have domestic tax exemptions when you're doing trades through IPO offering. So I think the way investors will start looking at India will undergo some kind of change, both in terms of the kind of returns and exits that they'll be, the valuation returns and exit strategies that they'll be looking at, and probably also to a certain extent in terms of the jurisdictions that they want to be investing from.
Thanks, Rajesh. I think the interesting thing about the press release is that it only talks about taking away the capital gains tax exemption benefit for alienation of shares.
The question which remains is, what about the capital assets which are not in the form of shares? So what happens to debentures? What happens to, let's say, interest in an LLP, given the fact that India has permitted foreign investment in LLPs also? Do those type of transactions still get the capital gains tax exemption as per the treaty? And the discussion becomes all the more relevant in the case of debenture is because of the fact that although the press release does mention about 7.5% withholding tax rate when the recipient is a Mauritius bank, it will be interesting to see if the recipient is not a bank in Mauritius and you know, it's like a, let's say, a debt fund. Would the same reduced interest withholding tax rate be applicable, given the fact that there were news reports in the past that as a trade-off for the capital gains tax exemption, which Mauritius might give away, they may be able to negotiate a reduced withholding tax rate for interest, you know, against that. So it will be interesting to see, you know, how this pans out. And maybe Mansi, if you want to throw some light on this, how Rajesh spoke about the taxation of the shares, but what happens to debt and other type of instruments? Is there any clarity or is there some more clarity which we can get from the protocol?
Sure. And I think, Nishal, this was something I had also mentioned earlier, how they're going to draft this capital gains clause will sort of, you know, dictate whether it's only equity shares that we are losing or India's gaining the taxing rights to, or will it also include the other securities? Because to the extent they only carve out shares, there may still be an argument to say that you can get capital gains benefits, say, for instance, on transfer of CCDs or other such instruments. And as you rightly mentioned, at least the press release right now only talks about the 7.5%, which will be applicable to banks, which actually right now are exempt. So interest paid to banks are not subject to withholding, but that has gone up to 7.5%. But the what based on news reports and what we'd heard, the original intention was that India, you know, that there should be a reduced withholding for interest that is paid from India. Because currently the way the clause is, it could go up to as much as 40% as far as interest is concerned. And that is why in the past we've not seen Mauritius being used as commonly where debt investments were concerned. You looked at other jurisdictions when Cyprus was blacklisted, a lot of investments were made through that, and maybe Singapore, Netherlands. But it'll be interesting to see once the protocol is out whether there is any sort of carve out for interest paid to other than banks and governments. So even where Singapore is concerned, as Rajesh mentioned, we might expect renegotiation or some changes on that front. Again, we'll have to see whether we lose the capital gains benefit just for that or can we carve out the other securities. Of course, Singapore has always had a better interest situation since, you know, you only have an exposure of about 15% in Singapore, and Netherlands also works in some cases because that has a reduced rate too. So I think once we have the protocol, we'll be able to look at this in more detail.
Sure. And in fact, I think a couple of points. One is the LLP point, which I just mentioned. I think this will be interesting given the fact that foreign investment in LLPs, which are in sectors where performance-linked conditions need not be met, is something which is allowed. And as you know, most of the sectors in India are under automatic route where there are no performance link conditions, you know, barring, you know, financial services sector and real estate sector. These are the two sectors where, you know, there are performance link conditions and, you know, defense and others. But most of the sectors are under automatic route without performance link conditions. So does this mean that, you know, the new businesses which are going to be set up, you know, or maybe the existing corporate structures, is there a scope for these structures to be converted into LLPs and still, you know, being eligible to get the capital gains tax exemption benefit as far as the Mauritius investor is concerned? You
Rajesh, you want to add? You will have a few others.
So I think you'll have a few other places, because I think the expectation is that the way the revised treaty will come out, which is similar to quite a few other treaties which India has entered into, which essentially says that as far as shares are concerned, India will have a right to tax. But in respect of items of income which are not covered in any of the other paragraphs in the capital gains article, which essentially talk about immovable property, equity shares, alienation of mobile property forming part of permanent establishment or ships and aircraft. In all of those situations, the right to tax will still rest in the country of residence and not in the country of source. So that actually throws up some interesting possibilities, especially when you're talking about it from a private equity investor standpoint, when you're talking about instruments like compulsorily convertible debentures, or you're talking about investment in a LLP. You can even sort of stretch the analogy when you talk about units in ARC or trust setup, mm-hmm. or redemption of units in case of AIF.
Right.
All of these are really situations which, if as we believe, the final treaty probably when it comes out, saying that items of income not covered
sure.
in any of the paragraphs will essentially come under this. So you still will have some degree of potential ability. I will come back, probably discuss the general anti-avoidance also for a little bit later on. But I think those are still potential avenues which are still open when you're looking at sort of structuring for investments into
sure.
various asset classes in India.
Sure. So in fact, I think the right time to discuss on the fund structuring, and Richie, you have been advising number of funds, both offshore and domestic GPs, raising funds from offshore and domestic LPs. With this protocol, do you see any preference for co-investment structure versus the unified structure, or vice versa?
Sure. So I think SEBI, the regulator, and even the Government of India has through different initiatives, circulars, etc., been highlighting and putting proper perspective to back domestic structure. So whether it was allowing Indian sponsored or managed AIFs, alternative investment funds, to be at par with any other domestic investor, irrespective of the amount of foreign money coming in, that clearly allowed foreign investors to access Indian markets without essentially making the Indian fund structures, being exposed to everyday policy, etc. So clearly we have seen a lot of policy shift from the government, from the regulators, including, a position that was taken by the tax department under the recently enacted Finance Act for this year, where they allowed tax-free benefits even on a look-through basis. So clearly a situation where the fund manager, the GP, is based out of India, And a large part of the asset allocation for the fund is going to be towards Indian portfolio opportunities, then definitely a unified structure makes a very compelling case as opposed to a co-investment structure where there's a different pool for offshore investors. I think what the current issue, given the protocol which came out yesterday, has sort of brought to highlight is more a case of direct investments versus a unified investment, where if, let's say, the large pool of investors or LPs are coming from offshore jurisdiction, does it make sense for us to pool them in an offshore jurisdiction to make direct investments into India? Or should we consider them directly investing into an AIF in India, perhaps? So there the discussion, is some, I would think, like somewhat yet to be settled. Like Rajesh indicated, you could always look at alternative jurisdictions alternative to Mauritius, like Netherlands. You could consider Sweden in certain cases, where you could pool LPs effectively and then make portfolio investments in India, and perhaps look at whether the treaty framework that they have in India, with India, does it allow to sort of take advantages from a tax perspective, given the kind of portfolio you're building. On the other hand, you could also look at, using instruments like a CCD, a convertible debt sort of option also to look at it. But again, this is again a debate with, between where your LPs are, what sort of investments you're looking to make, etc. I think the more relevant question now is for the existing fund managers and existing setups which are already there. What do they do if they are sitting on a Mauritius-only structure, or if they are sitting on a unified structure where the Mauritius feeder has sort of invested into the AIF, and the AIF is making investments. In those cases, you know, perhaps a call needs to be taken in what stage the fund is. If the fund is, let's say, post its commitment period, where the only drawdowns it would be making would be for meeting its operating expenses or follow-on rounds of existing portfolio companies, there perhaps a view may be taken that would a shift in the structure be required or not. Perhaps a communication will have to be made to the investors that, okay, subsequent exits may have potential tax issues over and above what was conveyed under the PPMs and the India tax sections which were depicted in those fund documents. The second scenario could be for those funds which are within their commitment period. They are pretty much set up. They have already made some investments, or they are actively going to make some investments, but the structure has already been set up. There is a Mauritius vehicle perhaps. There is perhaps a unified structure or a standalone Mauritius structure. There, potentially, they could take a call whether to make investments directly into India, or could they consider setting up SPVs in Netherlands or another SPV in Mauritius to make investments in India, and perhaps take an argument which Rajesh was also pointing out earlier, that if I am transferring shares of an entity, or if I am transferring instruments which are not covered under some of the paragraphs being dealt with under capital gains, could I make an argument that, okay, this is not something which would be taxable in India? So this is going to be a very interesting choice of decisions that a GP who is sitting on an existing fund, which has already been set up, will have to take. And that is definitely quite, different decisions which can be made depending on how the protocol is sort of released, in what form or shape. The third bucket, of course, is for those fund managers who are yet marketing the fund, or those who have, let's say, closed the fund but not yet done a drawdown. So for them, they could perhaps consider either an alternate structure, where instead of calling the commitment into an existing Mauritius vehicle, should they consider an alternate vehicle, or for those who have yet to, achieve a closing, perhaps, in midst of their marketing, should they consider a different vehicle or a different structure? So it is definitely a combination of different pros and cons. A, from a tax perspective, B, from a perspective that should they, switch to a unified structure, given that the FDA policy may not technically hamper them if they were to, route investments to an AIF module attached to the structure. So clearly there are a lot of issues to be taken into account.
Sure. So in fact, I think we have discussed about the direct investment structure. My question to you, Rajesh, is there any scope for still using Mauritius for indirect investment structure? So can there be two-tier, three-tier structures which would still work?
I think, surprisingly enough, one of the ripple effects of what you have in terms of the renegotiation of the treaty is that I think you're going to at least start seeing again indirect transfers coming back into the picture. Because the way the protocol reads, and this is similar to pretty much every treaty that India has negotiated on capital gains, even when they keep the source rule taxation framework in place, they don't really cover a scenario as far as indirect transfers are concerned, where on indirect transfers, it's still the country of residence which has the right to tax, because it usually falls within the residuary provision under the treaty. So I think one of the things which, I think two things that you're going to start seeing. One is that people are increasingly going to be looking at having SPV set up for investments into India with a two-tier structure. Of course, we do need to be cognizant about how the general anti-abuse rules, which are supposed to come into effect from 1st of April, will sort of tie in along with these structures, whether it has an impact as far as they are concerned. But I think that is something which you are going to see coming back into the picture again. Yes, that matter is also, you've had rulings from the High Court where they've clearly said that on indirect transfers, if there is a treaty which is there in place, under the treaty provisions, the right to tax will not necessarily vest with India, and the court refused to look at arguments relating to avoidance or sham. And with GAAR coming into place, people will look closely at those kind of structures also to see whether they will withstand potential challenges from a general anti-avoidance rule perspective. I think the second thing that you also interestingly going to see is many more corporate inversions happening, where you're going to have the actual portfolio company or investee company wanting to be headquartered outside of India, so that any investment which happens a layer above India, and any exit that happens also happens a layer above India. Those kind of structures, again, if you look at it, if you think about it over the last three odd years or four odd years, we've seen quite a bit of that happening, and I actually now see the trend increasing, where especially for companies or portfolio companies, investee companies, which have operations in multi-jurisdiction, I think if it is possible to structure having a holding company for such portfolio company outside of India, I think people will gradually tend to go towards those kind of situations, purely because then you're sort of getting around the treaty benefit. Of course, at all points in time, you're cognizant or you will be cognizant about how the new rules, some of the new rules like the place of effective management rules, which treat a foreign company as resident of India if the place of effective management is in India, or the general anti-abuse rules, how they sort of have a role to play. But I think where it is possible to establish the substance, where it's possible to establish a commercial rationale, where you can actually demonstrate both on paper and as a matter of factual, as a matter of fact, that the sole reason is not necessarily to avoid tax, or there is substance in those entities. I think those kind of structures will actually start coming back into play, purely because indirect transfers are not yet covered, I don't expect them to be covered either.
Sure. So I think what you are saying is there are structures which are still available inspired of the protocol, which should work, and I think that will definitely give a lot of comfort to the international investors, especially you know, for taxable investors, you know, they may still be okay to take a 10% hit on the long-term capital gains tax, given the fact that they may be able to get a credit in their jurisdiction. But for tax-exempt investors like pension funds, endowment funds, they usually don't like to pay any tax in the home jurisdiction or in the jurisdiction where they have invested. So I think this at least gives you know, good comfort that there is something which is available despite the protocol. But Richie, we have discussed a lot about private equity, and to a certain extent also applies to strategic investors who come through Mauritius. But I think the most important thing when it comes to tax-related announcement has been the foreign portfolio investors or the foreign institutional investors. And whenever any tax changes have been announced with respect to participatory notes, there has always been a mayhem in the market. And the government either rolls it back, you know, on the next day or a few days later. With this protocol, do you see any impact on the P note holders, either directly or indirectly?
Sure. So I think just to understand how from a tax regime we look at ODI P notes, pretty much, you know, whether we are following the standard ISDA contract notes or we are following warrants, these have been, you know, it's a market practice to you know, consider them as contractual arrangements, which per se should not have a tax consequence. The issue comes in the form that the issuer FPI, who has actually, you know, issued those notes, and they're hedging their own leg so that, you know, they have pretty much a back-to-back position. Issues arises on those aspects because the FPI which has issued the ODIs are actually sitting on Indian securities, which so far they were relying on the India-Mauritius Treaty or India-Singapore Treaty in other cases. And accordingly, a view could have been taken that, okay, on the hedge side, since there is no tax exposure, assuming they satisfy the requirements of getting the treaty eligibility, they in turn would not be passing any tax costs because from an issuer perspective, they would look at the tax in India as a cost, which perhaps could be sort of shared or passed on to the subscribers. But with the, you know, with the protocol coming in and you know, the now the lack of alignment as far as the tax treatment is concerned, perhaps from an issuer's perspective, they could, if they are continuing from a Mauritius or a Singapore perspective, they could map the redemption or winding up of ODI or P-notes to their own tax positions and accordingly pass on the tax in case there is an exit within 12 months because there is a potential tax on the short-term capital gain. If the ODIs are not being wound within 12 months, there is long-term capital gains, then there is fair amount of certainty that they could rely on the domestic tax rules themselves and perhaps not pass on the tax cost to the investor. Of course, this could lead to other interesting situations. What if the ODI subscriber does not redeem the position but only transfers the ODI, the P note, to another subscriber? In that case, clearly the market again is that they take prior approval from the subscriber before they, you know, sort of achieve the transfer. But because the underlying hedge position may not have been wound up, there the issue could come up that, okay, because potentially there was no tax, incidence in India, should there be a, you know, passing off of notional taxes at all, if at all? Conservative view could be taken that, okay, I may not be aware as an issuer what the tax situation could be. There could be a potential withholding, which has its own challenges. The other view, which we could, see some of the issuers take, because these are largely, globally, spread out institutions. What we could see is perhaps issuance of P-notes from jurisdictions like Netherlands, which, like Rajesh indicated, transfers below 10% of holding, which is pretty much the cap at which an FPI can take exposure in India, is exempt from tax. So we could see issuances from Netherlands. We could also see issuances from other jurisdictions, which have a tax treaty which, you know, allows the resident rule sort of to apply. Perhaps one example could be Sweden. That could also emerge as another jurisdiction which issuers could perhaps look at more closely going forward for issuance of ODI.
Okay. I think just one other point. I don't think merely because these rules have come, things will come to a standstill. Because one of the things is that most of the issuers, at least I am aware of quite a few, who are sitting on losses in their books, which they have carried forward, the short-term capital losses, which they have carried forward in their books, so that things don't necessarily have to come to a standstill. But I do believe that, you know, come March 2017, March, April, you're going to see a lot of flux, because it's going to become a lot more individual issuer-centric, in terms of the facts and circumstances surrounding each of the issuer as to whether or not they can actually, what is the stance that they will take. It's tough to sort of come out with a single standard market practice at this point in time, which everybody will tend to adopt. That sort of is what can become a big problematic.
Sure. So I think we have discussed most of the aspects of the press release. Rajesh, is there any takeaway that you would like to...
I think a couple of other points which I don't think we've really discussed, it's not really been in the news. I think the first one is the change in the rules as far as other income article is concerned. Because traditionally, Mauritius was one of the few jurisdictions which where the right to tax in case of income which is in the form of other income that is not covered under any of the other articles, the right vested with the state of residence and not the source state. I think that's one change that that you can expect in the treaty when the protocol comes out, that the right to tax other income will vest with India. Especially important when you start looking at issues surrounding Section 56 of the Income Tax Act, where essentially if a person has received shares at less than fair market value, there can be a tax in the hands of such recipient on the spread between the fair market value and the actual price paid. So I think that's one key aspect. Which
and interestingly, this is going to be very relevant because for, as we all know, that for foreign venture capital investors, there are no pricing restrictions for entry and exit. And we have seen number of restructurings where FACIs have swapped shares with the promoters at a very nominal value, which has been lower than the book value, and vice versa. And in those situations, these FACIs have relied on the India-Mauritius tax treaty to get out of Section 56 issue. But with this change in the protocol, if India is getting the right to tax that income, those restructurings are going to get difficult.
That is right. The only other changes apart from that is on exchange of information. But I think, as Nishit pointed out, I think if there's one area where I don't think the Indian government can ever complain is on exchange of information. I think they've pretty much got whatever information that they've got from Mauritius. So much so that they pretty much have a permanent office out there. But apart from that, doesn't seem to be too much otherwise. We still obviously need to see what the fine print in the protocol provides. But I think that sort of captures most of the changes which seems to have come out.
Yeah, but I think before we open the floor for the questions, I would just like to touch upon one more issue which is currently unresolved in the press release, but hopefully we might see something in the protocol. And that issue is something which is which could be bothering most of the investors is on convertibles. So what happens to a convertible, whether it's a compulsorily convertible preference share or compulsorily convertible debenture, which has been issued prior to 31st of March 2017, but it converts post 1st April 2017, would that be grandfathered or not? And it will be interesting to see how the protocol reads on this, because at least the press release says that any shares acquired after 1st April 2017 will be subject to tax in India, which means that even though the investment was made prior to 1st April 2017, because the shares will be acquired post-conversion after 1st April 2017, there could be a potential tax hit in India when these shares are sold. So this is something which is not clear, but looks like this could be an issue.
Yeah, and I think it especially becomes important when you're looking at potential portfolio companies which are probably on a path to IPO.
Yeah.
Where your choice is now saying that, do I wait to see to convert right before the IPO and take a risk as to how the protocol is going to come out? Or do I just convert right now and if the IPO happens, well and good, because I'll get a tax exemption when I actually do a offer for sale as part of the IPO. I think that becomes actually something very critical. I think a similar issue will happen in terms of any other restructuring when I'm doing a merger and all, and shares are being issued. But I think that's for that, I think we probably have to wait for the fine print.
Sure. So I think we can open the floor for questions from the participants.
Just one point that initially you might want to just inform the people that we are going to have another round of webinar, I think, India time tomorrow morning, California time tonight, and also a meeting in Palo Alto to physically discuss the protocol. So if you may want to just inform
this. Sure. So we are repeating this webinar tomorrow morning, India time at 9 a.m. So any of your colleagues who have missed joining this webinar, if they want to join, then it's at 9 a.m. tomorrow. So we can now take questions from the participants.
Sure, sir. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin with the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one on their touchtone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use only handset while asking questions. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. The first question is from the line of Jasdeep Sahani from BSR & Associates. Please proceed.
Good evening, presenters. Thank you so much for the valuable inputs. Just one question which came to my mind is when we spoke about the convertibles. So what in a scenario, what happens where there is a investment for a Mauritius company into its subsidiary, existing investment, and then there's a subsequent infusion of equity funds, which may so happen after April 17. So in that scenario, how will the taxability look like? I mean, how do we go about it?
So I think what will end up happening is that your first tranche investment, which came in prior to 31st March, on or prior to 31st March 2017, there you will have the benefit of getting the India, Mauritius, the capital gains benefit. But on the subsequent investment,
you are going to go under the revised provision. If obviously if the exit happens prior to 31st March 2019, you may still have the lower rate of tax. But if it's happening beyond that, you will end up being taxed at full rate. I think the intention there is very clear that they're going to look at when the shares were actually acquired and not necessarily go in to say that, well, you had one part of the investment prior, second tranche investment came in later. I don't think how that they have looked at it.
And I presume the same treatment should apply in case of bonus shares, if any. I mean, just a thought.
That is correct, yeah. That because the way the protocol seems to be reading is that you just look at when the shares have been acquired. So even if the bonus shares were issued at a later point in time, so even though under the, let's say, you have different kinds of situations, right? For example, if you look at something like a CCD, even though under the domestic law that's not regarded as a transfer, and the holding period sort of continues, but the way the press release seems to indicate is that you only look at the time when the shares were actually acquired, irrespective of anything else. So irrespective of what the domestic law actually provides for, so you actually look at the time when the shares were actually acquired by the Mauritian resident. Whether it's going to be bonus shares, whether it's going to be equity shares issued on conversion of a CCPS, equity shares issued on conversion of a CCD, it seems to indicate that in all of those situations, if it's done post on or post 1st April 2017, the treaty benefits don't necessarily apply or apply in the reduced form.
Sure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Vijay Vagmare from Metro India Services. Please proceed. Vijay, your line is unmuted. You may please proceed with your question.
Yeah. Thank you, President, for this valuable presentations. Just one question: that do you think whether company would move their base to other geographies?
I think that was one of the things which I mentioned, that there is a possibility companies may look at having some sort of corporate inversion to have a holding company outside of India, not for any other reason, so that any investors or any external parties actually come at a layer above India. So I think those are structures which people will actually look at pretty actively. While it may not have an impact as far as the FDI inflow which is coming into India is concerned, but we do think that people, especially those who have a more international operational presence as far as business is concerned, they will want to look at it actively. Or where the business model actually sees them being in multiple geographies. I think for those kind of people, having an Indian headquartered company may not necessarily make potentially happy sense.
Okay. And which jurisdiction do you think, again, in your view?
I think that will be a mix of where really the business is intended to be carried on more than anything else. You do have multiple jurisdictions around it, but it's going to be focused more around where the business presence would require them to be.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Malay Makkar from CSB. Please proceed.
Hi, you were mentioning about P-notes. Does this specifically refer to P-notes with the underlying of equity, or does this also refer to, I mean, total return swaps? Is there any clarity on that? And secondly, if you could also throw some light on the debt, the existing status of taxation via Netherlands for, debt investors.
Sure. No, so clearly P-notes as a subject is not something which was discussed by the treaty originally or not envisaged to be discussed with the protocol coming in. Our observations on P-notes are more to do with business reality where a position abroad is somewhat hedged in India. An unhedged position pretty much is something which we've not seen market participants sort of have. So accordingly, on the hedged position where they are holding the existing shares, their situation is no different from the position of any other entity holding shares in India, which in case of a TRS, it is pretty much that of a listed company share. And accordingly, our view and position is in keeping with that business objective.
Just to respond to your second question on a treatment of interest from Netherlands lender, the withholding tax rate in India when an Indian company pays any interest coupon to Netherlands is 10%. Which is the same in Cyprus also. I mean, which was the same in Cyprus, but now, as you know, Section 94A has changed that to 30% as per the Income Tax Act. In Singapore, this rate is 15%. And in Mauritius, we'll have to see the protocol whether 7.5% is also extended to lenders who are not Mauritius banks.
Sorry, I think I should have drafted my questions better, but essentially what I wanted to understand in the first question was, when you're referring to P notes, clearly your reference is to the underlying being shares, equity shares. In the draft guidelines that have come out, I mean, what if the underlying to a P note is a debenture, is a fixed income instrument?
Sure. So let me sort of take it up. So if your instrument is, let's say, a debenture, then there are only two aspects that can happen. The first one is that it's probably a TRS against a NCD issuance, which is done to AFII.
Right.
So as far as the interest coupon is concerned, if the revisions are essentially going to get you down to a 7.5% position, well and good, you get the benefit of that in terms of the tax rate coming down. On the debt proceeds which are being paid off. The second alternative which can happen is when there's a redemption. If the treatment ends up being that of capital gains at the time of redemption, in that case, looking at the way we believe that the treaty will probably end up, this will probably go under the residuary provision of the capital gains tax provisions, where the right to tax will still rest with Mauritius. So in all probability, I think people who are holding TRS on NCDs may probably not be adversely affected as much as some of the other investors if the final paragraph comes out the way we are looking at it.
Understood. And vis-a-vis Netherlands, I mean, what's the taxation status for fixed income investors?
So that would be essentially, if you're going under the treaty, it's a 10% rate as far as coupons are concerned. And on cap gains, it's a similar position to what I mentioned, which is that if it's a redemption of a debenture which is treated as capital gain, in that case, the right to tax could still rest.
Sure. Earlier, you had also mentioned that for Netherlands, there is a ceiling of 10%. So if the FPI's shareholding is less than 10% in a company and then there's a transfer, then there's absolutely no problem in case of an excess. Greater than 10% shareholding, so there is, then there are two further options. But obviously, something like this, a 10% ceiling threshold kind of a thing, cannot be denominated for debt investors. Or is there something that is...
There is no ceiling.
Mr. Mukherjee?
Sure, thank you. Yeah, thanks.
Your questions?
Thank you.
The next question is from the line of Meenu Agarwal from Smart Capital. Please proceed.
Hello. Yeah, I wanted to know. So this provision also talks about the shares of an Indian company. So when it says Indian company, does it only consider the shares of Indian company, or it can also have the shares of a Singapore company, which is a holding company of an Indian company?
The interpretation which the courts have given in the past on similar treaty provisions in other treaties has been that when you talk about shares of Indian company, you're actually talking about an Indian company. Cannot be extended to situations to cover, let's say, shares of a Singapore company. The only exception which you can potentially think about is if the Singapore company is treated as an Indian tax resident because of the POEM guidelines. But otherwise, if it's an indirect transfer which happens, where, let's say, a foreign investor is selling shares of a Singapore company, which has underlying Indian assets, or in case of shares of a Mauritius company having underlying Indian assets, that will generally not be taxed in India if the investor is coming in from, let's say, a Mauritius or a Singapore. The one caveat I should add is that, of course, you do have to look at the general anti-abuse rules to ensure that you don't trip that in terms of the transaction one layer above being questioned on the grounds of being an abusive transaction.
So in what scenario the Singapore company can also come into the picture? Means it can be treated as if since the only business of the holding company is from India, so this will also be treated as an Indian company.
No, that is not how it works. It works if the Singapore company is treated as a tax resident of India, because the place of effective management of the Singapore company is in India. That's the only circumstance that you're talking about. But merely because the Singapore company has investments in India, as long as you can demonstrate that the general anti-avoidance rules do not apply, a sale of shares by, let's say, a Singapore resident of another Singapore company which holds underlying Indian assets would not be taxed in India.
And
the same position will apply for shares.
Okay, and even if an Indian resident holds the share of that Singapore company, that has nothing to do with this, right?
No, the Indian resident holding shares of a Singapore company, that's a different matter, because the Indian resident will anyway be taxed on the global income. So the Indian resident is not going to be getting any treatment.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
Thank you. This question is from the line of Seth Freeman from EM Capital Management. Please proceed.
Yes, thank you for conducting this informational conference call. One of the issues for this 50% phase-in amount is to have this limitation of this minimum limitation of benefits level of operation expenses. And you know, do you think that the government's going to come out and clarify specifically what they mean by expenditure on operations? That's one of the questions. So I think for foreign investors, or U.S. investors anyway, it's going to be a critical component of sort of the headache factor of continuing to deal with Mauritius if you now have to operationalize something. And then I think we also have to really, you know, what do you see happening? I mean, your law practice should be flooded with business about 3 years and 10 months from now, because with Mauritius basically becomes redundant.
Seth, let me answer this question for you. On the first question, do I think the government is going to come out with clarification? The answer is a clear no. If you look at it, what they seem to have reproduced is something similar to a provision that they already have under the protocol to the India-Singapore Treaty, which has some very similar language, which talks about a spending in Singapore, a spending in respect of the operations in Singapore of more than Singapore dollar 200,000 in two blocks of 12 months preceding the realization of capital gains. They have sort of extrapolated the same language and put it into the protocol to the Mauritius Treaty. So I don't expect the government to come out with any further clarification on what they actually mean by expenditure on operations in Mauritius. It would really be a fact-dependent test that you would have to go through each of the line items in your P&L to see on the nature of expenditure, whether it can qualify as expenditure on operations in Mauritius. So that's the way I think people will have to do it. That's something that people have been doing in the past as far as Singapore is concerned. They will end up doing a similar exercise as far as Mauritius is concerned. I think the second point was 3.5 years down the line, people flooding. I think it's going to be a lot earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. The next question is from the line of Pradnya Guge from Edelweiss. Please proceed.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for your valuable inputs. The query I have is, there was a mention of two-tier structure where, in order to get the benefit of taxation into India. So is it that a fund can have a two-tier structure in different jurisdictions and then enter into India? And if that is so, what would be the right jurisdictions to enter?
So I think when you're talking about two-tier structures, what you're essentially saying is that the top-tier entity is selling the entity which actually holds the shares in the Indian company. You would want to ensure that the top-tier entity is there in a treaty jurisdiction. Because if it's in a non-treaty jurisdiction, then under the domestic Indian tax law, the transaction will be brought within the Indian tax net. The second thing that you would want to ensure, without getting into specifics of the jurisdiction, is that the top-tier entity at any point in time, any of those structures, you need to be cognizant about the general anti-avoidance rules. You do need to have a strong business purpose in order to have established the structure as it stood, so that tomorrow there is no challenge as far as the tax authorities trying to invoke the general anti-abuse rules. In the past, when we have seen two-tier structures, there's been very little discussion or debate, whether it's been before the authority for advanced ruling or even before the High Court. There's been not much discussion on multi-tiered structures, where they've gone into what constitutes business purpose. But you have some cases which have provided a guidance around it. I think a good example is the Vodafone case. So you do need to be cognizant to ensure that there is a proper, genuine rationale for setting up a structure in a particular manner and divesting in a particular manner, in order to ensure that the GAAR rules don't apply. But otherwise, as I said, most treaties, jurisdictions end up working, subject obviously to the domestic law in each of those jurisdictions.
Okay, but so earlier we always saw a feeder master structure wherein the master used to be in the, say, Mauritius or Singapore. But now with the changes in the capital gains taxation in Mauritius, what would be the other place of likelihood? Would it be Netherlands? Would it be beneficial from taxation perspective?
Yeah, so Netherlands is a good alternative to consider. But again, like we indicated that, you know, you'll have to look at each of the treaties very carefully and also map it to the kind of portfolio that you're constructing. Is it a debt fund? Is it a equity-focused fund, etc.? Could you have leeway within the structuring? Could you do a CCD or a convertible sort of instruments? So there are a few factors that still inform what jurisdiction you approach. And then frankly, in any event, it has to be of some LP comfort. Otherwise, you know, you could have considered other jurisdictions. But a more mature geography, which has good fund administration regime also in play, is something that should be considered.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
The next question is from the line of Natalie Fan from Partners Group. Please proceed.
Hi, thanks for the informative presentation. I just wanted to clarify on the jurisdictions that you mentioned for investing into India. So with the Mauritius-India Treaty being amended and the Singapore Treaty that will also be affected, you just mentioned we can possibly consider Netherlands. So I wonder if there is also the limitation of benefits clause in the Netherlands Treaty, and if so, and also you actually mentioned like the Netherlands Treaty is not as beneficial as the Mauritius and Singapore ones. So apart from Netherlands and Cyprus, are there other jurisdictions that you think we may consider when we make private equity investments in India?
So a couple of things. Netherlands per se does not have a limitation of benefit. The treaty doesn't have a limitation of benefit. I think a couple of factors which always sort of have to have a role to play. One is that Netherlands itself has some internal anti-abuse rules. So you do need to be careful to ensure that you don't trip the internal the Dutch anti-abuse rules. The second is also the Indian general anti-abuse rules, which are proposed to come into effect from 1st of April 2017. So I think it's more about working around how the anti-abuse rules are going to work to ensure that even when you have a Dutch structure, if you think about it
you have a lot of structures which are out there, which is usually a co-op holding a BV, holding investments in India. Those kind of structures have been pretty common in the past, and those can probably still work as long as you don't trip around on the general anti-abuse rules, whether in India or the anti-abuse rules in Netherlands. When I talked about the Netherlands not being as favorable as Mauritius and Singapore, the downside that really that you have in Netherlands is that if you're holding more than 10% equity stake and you're selling the shares to an Indian resident, in that situation, India gets a right to tax. But if you're selling to a non-resident, then the transaction is not taxable in India. And obviously, in Netherlands, you will end up with a participation exemption to ensure that there is no tax in Netherlands. So I think the key here is really, even when you're trying to use Netherlands as a jurisdiction for investment, as to what the exit strategy is. So in certain cases, Netherlands does work pretty well in certain exit strategies, in others, not necessarily going to be the case. Apart from Netherlands, are there any other jurisdictions at this point in time which have generally been what I would look at as well established? The answer to that is not necessarily so, at least not compared to some of the others that we spoke about. Cyprus, as I already mentioned, because of the notification by the Indian government, which is currently in the Supreme Court on that particular matter. So we do need to wait and watch as to what really happens on Cyprus.
Okay, got it. And just one more question about like Singapore treaty, because actually we do have operations in Singapore, but the only thing is like when we set up Singapore SPVs to make India investments, we try not to like use the operating company as the SPV. So we try to segregate like the investments from our operations. So I just wonder how we can fulfill the limitation of benefits with the convenience of having operations in Singapore.
So a couple of points. One is that the moment the Mauritius Treaty goes off, the Singapore Treaty also automatically falls away because of the linkage between the two treaties. As far as you know, on the current investment, the expectation is that the government is going to renegotiate the Singapore Treaty on very similar lines to Mauritius, which means there would be a grandfathering as far as investments made prior to 31st March 2017. On fulfillment of the criteria for limitation of benefit under the Singapore Treaty, usually what ends up happening is that even though you're not using the operating company for the purposes of making investments, you do have SLAs or service level agreements in place where you cross-charge the requisite set of services which are being provided to each of the SPVs, to those entities, in order to meet the conditions under the LOB. Because that is something that does get, that is permitted. Obviously, there will also be external service providers, whether it's the bankers or the lawyers or the accountants, who will also be cross-charging to the SPV. So those are methods that you sort of end up using to ensure that you meet the conditions under the LOB as it stands currently in the Singapore Treaty.
So you're saying like the LOB requirement is only regarding the expenditure amount, but there's no substance requirement like need to have people on the ground, employees in the SPV, a fixed office and stuff like that?
The Singapore Treaty has only two requirements. The first one is that the main purpose is not to obtain benefit of the India-Singapore Treaty on capital gain. So you need to establish or demonstrate that there were ancillary reasons or there were other reasons as to why you choose Singapore as a base. For example, you're investing in multiple jurisdictions, not just India. But does the treaty actually say that, no, you need to have people on the ground, you need to have an office, you need to have X, Y, or Z? The treaty doesn't talk about anything. The treaty only says that spend for operations in Singapore of $200,000 in each of the blocks, two blocks of 12 months preceding realization of capital gains. You satisfy that test, you're deemed not to be a conduit. And independently, you need to satisfy the test that the main purpose was not to take benefit of the India-Singapore Treaty on Capital Gains. Those are the only two criteria that you need to satisfy as on date.
Right, but in practice, I guess the Indian tax authority will still look at the real substance of...
In practice, you want to end up trying to ensure that your structure is as robust as it can be, and which is why where you have the ability to put in offices, where you have the ability to put in people on the ground, you tend to do it, because where you can do it, you would want to do it. As I said, the other mechanisms that we have seen is having the service level agreements, common use of office space between all the SPVs and all of that. So it's usually been a kind of mix and match depending on what is the kind of setup and what's the kind of structure that you have. Because one thing when you step back and think about it, in a private equity sort of business, it's not a people-heavy business. So you can't necessarily put in 30 people on the ground in every jurisdiction or every SPV. That's not something that's possible. So you do have to sort of tailor or customize your requirements, even when you're talking about substance.
Okay, got it. That's all from my side. Thanks.
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up question from the line of Meenu Agarwal from Smart Owner. Please proceed.
Hello. Sorry for calling again. So what I asked is whether it can be applicable to a Singapore company, which is a 99% shareholder of an Indian company. And the answer that you gave is no, but there is some line of exception. Can you repeat that one more time?
No, I think, what I was talking about was...
Yeah, I think the only exception which Rajesh was mentioning was if the Singapore company is considered as a tax resident of India, then in that situation, it will be considered as an Indian company, and then only in that situation, it will get attracted.
Okay, and when the Singapore company can be considered as a tax resident of India?
When its place of effective management is in India.
Okay. Management, if the management decisions are taken in India.
Yeah.
Okay, so if I have to explain more, I can tell you that the directors of the Singapore company and the director of the Indian company, subsidiary company, is a kind of common.
So can I request one thing? I'll give you an email ID, webinarmauritius.nde@nishitdesai.com. Maybe I think it will be good if you can just send us a mail and we'll be happy to respond to that query. I think there are some more questions, which are lined up. So we can take that offline if you don't mind.
It's nda@ndalaw.com, right?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. I'll send an email.
Thank you. A reminder to the participants, if you have any questions, you may press star and one at this time. Mr. Joshipura, there are no questions in the queue.
Sure. So I think, we have seen the press release and clearly before taking any decision on new structures or on restructuring, it will be important to see the fine print of the protocols. And, I think the structures will evolve over a period of time depending on, the language of the protocol. With this, we'll close the webinar, and I would like to thank all the participants for joining this webinar. And as we mentioned earlier, we'll be repeating this webinar tomorrow morning, 9 a.m. India time. So in case any of your colleagues who are, or contacts who have missed joining this webinar, we'll be happy to help them tomorrow morning. Once again, thank you for joining the webinar.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes today's conference call. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.